Mission Vallejo from Southern California.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Patty, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm grateful to be sober and be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I need to correct Cindy when she asked me about the Serenity Prayer. I didn't say, yeah, I think so. I said yes, and we need to do it after the preamble. I'm rigid. It doesn't feel like a meeting to me unless you do it right. I need to clean up here a little bit. I'm an untreated Al-Anon, and if there's... No, untreated is all right. It's when they get treated that we have to worry about them. You shouldn't feed me sugar before I do this. I want to thank the committee for inviting me, and I want to thank Lindy for picking me up at the airport. I got off the Let's Pretend airplane. In Stockton, I don't have any fear of flying. I have a small fear of crashing and burning. But flying doesn't bother me much. And I got from San Jose on the Let's Pretend airplane that they have to put the rubber bands on to make the things go around. They have no stewardesses, no bathrooms. And I got off the plane, and Lindy was standing with her grapevine in her hand like this. And I thought, well, now that's a dedicated member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Never leave home without it. I think I was the only one getting off that plane that didn't look like an alcoholic, too. So, anyway, so I'm real glad to be here, and I hope by the time I'm done, you're glad that I came. I'm going to take my shoes off now that we're all intimate friends. I think I'm cuter short, anyway. I've never understood high heels. Men invented them. Women have to wear them. You know, it's... I want to tell you a little bit about what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. When I share, I bring notes with me. And the note says, very simply, tell them your name and tell them the truth. I've told you my name. I'm not so sure I'm going to tell you the truth. What I am going to do is I'm going to share with you my perspective of what it used to be like. A lot of what I'm going to share with you was reported to me. Some of it's documented. We can go back and look it up if we need to prove it. But I don't know about anybody in this room, but when I was out there, I had no idea the day would come that I would be standing in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous sharing what it used to be like. If I had known then that I would be here tonight, I would have taken notes while I was out there. Certainly I would have done some things differently. I've done things that humiliated even me, knowing that I have to report them to you. I would have lived quite differently if I had known I was going to be here, but I didn't know I was coming. So what I'm going to share with you is what I think it used to be like. And everything I know in retrospect. I certainly, as I was going on, did not know that I was fast becoming a pig. I thought I was kind of cute. I thought I was in fact very successful, and that almost killed me in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was successful out there. I was a chronic, hopeless, helpless alcoholic, and I didn't have a clue. I was the last to know. In fact, I was in Alcoholics Anonymous sober for 8.5 months. Before it occurred to me that I was an alcoholic. My denial was pretty strong, and it stayed intact for quite a while in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had my first drink when I was 13 years old. I grew up in an alcoholic home. I'm not going to share too much of that with you because I can't stand to see grown people cry. And it's just it's one of those sad, tear-wrenching stories that would just have all of you besides yourself. You probably wouldn't be able to enjoy the rest of the evening if I shared it with you. Let it suffice to say, though, that I did grow up in an alcoholic home. That has nothing to do with my alcoholism. I don't remember my father, the drunk, ever throwing me down on the floor, prying my mouth open, and pouring Jack Daniels down my throat. I became an alcoholic because at 13 years old, I chose to drink alcohol. And I continued to drink alcohol until I drank myself into alcoholism. And then I just went ahead and developed my potential and drank for several more years. until I couldn't drink anymore. And that's what brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's where my alcoholism came from. I had my first drink at 13. I'm a little sorry I waited that long, but I guess I just never had much of an opportunity before then. I was on a camping trip with a group of girls. We were camped at the beach in Southern California. We got into the tent that night, and I had a bottle of vodka in my pillowcase. And to this day, I don't know where that bottle came from. I don't remember ever thinking about drinking before that night. I don't remember planning the moment that I would be able to get my hands on a bottle of alcohol. That vodka just seemed to be in my pillowcase mysteriously. I took it out, and I asked if anybody wanted any of it, and they didn't. And the reason they gave me for not wanting any was all we had to mix with it was grape soda and root beer. And I said, so what? And I took the top off, and I drank half the bottle. And I looked around the tent, and nothing had gotten different, and nothing had changed. So I drank the second half of the bottle, and that was to be the end of my social drinking. Never again after that day did I ever offer anybody a drink out of my bottle. I had no resentments before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. One of my early resentments in Alcoholics Anonymous was when I heard you talk about your first drink. I heard many of you talk about your first drink, and you talk about taking a mouthful of alcohol and feeling it warm down your throat, and you felt its warmth go into your stomach, and then it got to your stomach, and it exploded, and it went to your fingertips, and went to your toenails, your pimples fell off. You grew about 4 inches, you lost 50 pounds, and you became Don Juans and Lady Dies, and marvelous things happened to you when you drank. That wasn't my case. My first drink of alcohol, absolutely nothing happened to me. I finished that bottle of vodka, I sat in that tent, I looked around, and everything was exactly the same as it had been. Nothing happened. The only thing that did happen, after about 15 minutes, I had to go to the bathroom, and I think if you drank a quart of anything, that would happen to you. I got out of the tent, I shuffled down the beach to the outhouse, I went in and went to the bathroom, and when I got done and went to get up, I realized I was absolutely, totally, 100% paralyzed to the toilet seat. I couldn't blink, I didn't think my heart was beating, and I was overcome with the sense of fear. And the fear was that somebody else was going to have to come use that outhouse, and there I was, paralyzed to the toilet seat. Now, later in my drinking, I did discover that two people can use the same toilet at the same time if the second person is very careful about what they're doing. But I didn't know that at 13 years old. And so what I did was I somehow intuitively knew that there was energy somewhere in my body, and I intuitively knew that if I could kind of get that energy all balled up, if I could get it till it seemed to be in one central location, that I would be all right. So I got all that energy from anywhere in my body. I got it till it seemed to be in a little cluster, and when it seemed to be all gathered up, I just fell off the toilet, out the door, and started crawling back to the tent. Now, since coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, I've discovered that my entire problem that night was my attitude. If my attitude would have been right, I could have had this wonderful fantasy that I was in the Marines and I was being dive-bombed as I was trying to get back to safety. And if my attitude would have been right, it could have been a wonderful experience. Now, in my own defense, I have to tell you, my pants were still down at my ankles. I had started to get sick, and I couldn't quite get through it, and I couldn't get around it, and under those circumstances, a little difficult to have a good attitude. I did manage somehow to get back to the tent. I fell in, and I passed out. And when I came to in the morning, I realized nobody was in the tent with me, and I couldn't figure out where they went until my eyes cleared enough that I realized I'd been sick all night long. I'd hit the top of the tent, the side of the tent, the floor of the tent, and I didn't want to be in there either, so I got out of the tent. And that was my first drink of alcohol, and it was the most wonderful, marvelous, incredible, spiritual, magnificent, fabulous experience I'd ever had. And it must have been, because I put some amount of alcohol into my body on a daily basis from that day until the day I came to the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't always get drunk. And I didn't always drink the kinds of things that you would classify as a beverage. I drank a lot of mouthwash. I drank a lot of vanilla extract. I used to buy it by the six-pack. I drank a lot of perfume. Taboo became my after-dinner drink of choice. We tell new people, if you don't want to slip, don't go where it's slippery. There aren't many places that are safe for me. I ate and drank everything in the bathroom. I often am tempted when I introduce myself, I'm tempted to introduce myself and say, I'm Patty and I'm a pig. Because I ate, drank, shot, snorted, shoved, rammed, crammed anything into me that would make me feel different than how I felt. And it wasn't always, like I said, it wasn't always something that you would classify as a beverage. Alcohol is my drug of choice. I love alcohol. I love the way it looks. I love the way it smells. I love the way it tastes. I love the way it sounds. I love alcohol. And what drug of choice means to me is if there's a bottle of Jack Daniels here, some marijuana, some cocaine, some Valium, some stuff, drug of choice means I drink the Jack Daniels first, and then I do everything else. I love alcohol. I love sleazy bars. I was a 6 a.m. bar drinker. I love sleazy bars. I like the ones you walk into where they have that smell of used booze and urine. I mean, it's only... I salivate thinking of it. I just... I was a 6 a.m. bar drinker. I would get to the bar at 6, walk up to the door, and if you're a 6 a.m. bar drinker, you know the story. You walk up to the door, and you reach out, and you take the handle, and you're a little early. Bar's not open, so you keep walking. You walk down to the corner, and you stand there like you've got a good reason to be there. And then you wait a little bit, and you turn around, and you walk back, and you reach out as you're walking by, and it's open. And you go in, and I don't know why they could never stock the bar the night before. The bartender's in there, he's cleaning the stupid ashtrays, he's putting beer in the cooler, and you're standing there acting like it's not important. You're just passing by anyway. And you finally cough and get his attention, order a drink, and then tell him to make it a double because you can see how busy he is. And you get the drink, and you get the drink, and you get the drink, and you get the drink. And sometimes you go on with the rest of your day, and sometimes that is the rest of your day. And I never knew which way it was going to go. I never knew which way it was going to go, if that was going to be where I was to be all day. I never planned it to do that. I never planned to stay there all day, but, you know, important people would come in. There were deals to be discussed. There were business opportunities going on. I was in the newspaper business. I got a lot of stories in those places. I mean, I couldn't cut off my contacts and be rude and leave and go to the office in the middle of something important. I mean, we were brain surgeons. We were top management presidents of big companies. We were a lot of things. And it all started for me. It started at 6 a.m. in that sleazy bar when the magic would happen to me. The magic of alcohol would happen to me, and I could be somebody else. And I never knew that. I never knew that during that time that I was drinking. I went to college. I graduated from college with a 3.8 grade point average. I stayed and took classes for a master's degree because I'm the kind of person, if I'm doing anything well, I want to keep doing it. And I seemed to do school well, so I stayed and worked on a master's degree. I left. I went to San Diego State. I left there because I believed I had taken all the classes San Diego State had to offer. That's why I thought I was leaving San Diego. Did not occur to me that I might be leaving because I had one more drunk driving assault charge pending. Another resentment I got early in Alcoholics Anonymous, I came here and found out you can get arrested for a single charge of drunk driving. I never knew that. I always got arrested for drunk driving assault. And it had something to do with how I got out of the car. I Now, in my brilliant mind, I quickly diagnosed that as a driving problem. And so then I would walk to the bar. I was a bar drinker, among other places. I was a bar drinker. I did all the things women bar drinkers do. I did a lot of things men bar drinkers do. I was never fussy about my behavior. But if you've developed a driving problem and you're a bar drinker, I just started to walk to the bar. And then I'd get arrested for drunken public assault. And it never occurred to me that had anything to do with alcohol. That was you and they and them. It was circumstances and conditions. It was a lot of things. Never occurred to me it had anything to do with alcohol. And one night I did this thing. I thought it was clever then. I still think it's pretty clever today. One night when they were locking up, I just kind of hid out in the bar. And that night I got arrested for breaking and entering assault. Never once occurred to me it had anything to do with alcohol. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I heard you talk about alcohol being the problem. Alcohol wasn't the problem for me. Alcohol was the solution for me. Alcohol was the thing that made it okay for me to be out there. I could go to work. I could go to school. I'd go to the grocery store, the laundromat, the library. I could do that stuff. Alcohol was the solution for me. Never once occurred to me alcohol was the problem. I laugh often in Alcoholics Anonymous when we read that portion of Chapter 3 where it talks about we tried to control and enjoy our drinking. I don't think those two words go together. You can either control or you can enjoy, but you can't do both. And I was always into enjoy. So it never occurred to me that any of the problems in my life had anything to do with alcohol. But I didn't realize I was leaving San Diego because I had another drunk driving assault charge pending. I didn't think I was leaving because I had a roommate who was a little annoyed with me. I had a roommate who was really, really inconsistent. Along with my chronic alcoholism, I also had a tremendous amount of compassion. Now, this may offend some of you. If it does, I guess you deserve it. But the guys that drank in the kind of bars that I drank in, the guys had two basic lines. My wife doesn't understand, and I have no place to stay tonight. And then I had all this compassion. So I would say, well, listen, I'll take you home with me tonight, but I don't want to talk to you again until the bar closes. So the bar would close. Being a lady of my word, I would take this guy home with me. We'd get to my house. I'd send him into the bedroom, telling him I had to go to the bathroom. He'd go into the bedroom. I would go into my bedroom on the left, and I had just sent him in with my roommate. Now, some nights, that would be okay with her. Some nights, she wouldn't mind at all. Other nights, she'd get really upset. And within a matter of minutes, she'd be at my door, banging on the door, screaming and yelling. You know, I had 7 o'clock classes. I had to get some sleep here, you know. And if it would have always been all right or never been all right, I'd have been okay. But her inconsistent, you'd have drank if you lived with her. She was so inconsistent. And I didn't think I was leaving because she was a little annoyed with me. I truly believed I was leaving because I'd taken all the classes San Diego State had to offer. So I loaded everything I owned into my car, left San Diego, and I was headed for Northern California. I got to Santa Ana, which is 66 miles from where I started from. I was out of booze, and I was thirsty. I'd taken 2 cases of beer and 2 bottles of booze. I was out of booze, and I was thirsty. I pulled off the freeway. I have a sense I could find the sleaziest bar in town without even looking for it. I pulled into the parking lot of this place. I walked in. There was sawdust on the floor. Somebody had thrown up several weeks before that, and they hadn't cleaned it up. The room was full of smoke. Willie Nelson was singing on the jukebox, and I knew I was home. I sat down. I ordered a drink, and that's as far north as I ever got, 66 miles from where I started from. Alcohol controlled where I would live, where I would work, the people I would run with, and eventually the people I would run from. And I didn't have a clue. I thought I drank because I wanted to drink. I had absolutely no idea that at 13 years old I had put alcohol into an alcoholic body, and from that day on I had no choice. I thought I drank because I wanted to drink. I went to work and I rose very quickly to the top of my profession. I had a big oak desk. I had trophies and plaques that said I was good at what I did. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, that success almost killed me because I told you about that big oak desk. What I didn't tell you about was the mornings at 5 o'clock that I would come to wrapped around the leg of that desk, the cleaning lady coming in, and I don't know anybody but an Al-Anon who enjoys the sound of a vacuum cleaner, but... but... I don't know. This woman's coming in to clean my office, and I'm trying to tell her I like it this way. And there's a bottle in that desk drawer, and if I can just get a hit off of that bottle, I'm going to be okay. And I didn't tell you about those mornings. I didn't tell you I was in the newspaper business. We were a community paper, and we often presented awards to civic groups. And because God had given me a gift and I was good at what I did, we often received awards. I didn't tell you about the times that I'd be standing at a podium much like this in a room full of people holding an award, not knowing if I was giving it or receiving it. And so I would say thank you and go sit down. And then somebody would elbow me and tell me I was presenting it to the Junior Women's League and I'd have to get back up and start over again. And I didn't tell you about that stuff. I told you I was too young. I was 26 years old. I was much too young to be an alcoholic. I graduated with a 3.8 grade point average. I took classes for a master's degree. I was too smart to be an alcoholic. I was too successful to be an alcoholic. I heard you talk about sleeping under bridges, and I hadn't done that. I heard you talk about drinking in L.A. and coming to in New Jersey, and I hadn't done that. I heard you talking about losing families, and I hadn't done that. Of course, I hadn't had one either, but and those are the things that I told you about. And one day an old timer grabbed me and he said, Patty, he said, people who aren't alcoholic don't have lists of reasons why they're not. They just simply aren't. And so I stopped sharing my list with you. And I stopped telling you, and I just sat in your rooms and knew that I didn't belong. I got to Alcoholics Anonymous as a result of one more drunk driving assault. The sheriff in Orange County has absolutely no sense of humor. I'm the kind of person, I get released from jail, I get the arrest report, and I read it, and I find out where I made my mistake so that I can practice that part so that next time I'll get that part right. And you see, I always knew there'd be a next time. I always knew there'd be a next time, and I had practiced field sobriety tests a lot. And I was really good at field sobriety tests by the last time I was stopped. And I would have given myself an A+. I was doing very well on the test. And at the end of it, the officer asked me to say the ABCs backwards. Well, the time before that, I had responded with, well, I can't even do that sober. Well, then I had just confessed, right? So they... they took me off. So this last time, when he asked me to say the ABCs backwards, I said, okay, and I turned around... See, you think it's funny. He didn't think it was funny. I was turned around, he cuffed me, took me to Orange County Jail, and he put me in a cell with criminals. And I knew I didn't belong there. I mean, there were real criminals in there. There were prostitutes, there were burglars, there were thieves, there were women who'd been arrested for beating their husband, which I don't think should be a crime, but they locked you up for it. And I didn't belong there, so I tried to organize a prison break. And it was a simple plan. I explained this plan very carefully to the criminals. We're going to take our coffee cups, we're going to bang them on the bars and make a lot of noise. When the marshal comes to see what's going on, I'm going to throw my arm out around her neck, get her keys, and we're going to get out of here. And I heard something I was to hear in Alcoholics Anonymous. One of those criminals looked at me and she said, why don't you sit down and shut up? And I said, fine, then y'all stay, but I'm getting out of here. Now I was going like a mad woman on those bars. There's a couple problems with styrofoam cups. The first one is they don't make a lot of noise. The second one is the bars have a tendency to eat them up. And when the bars ate it up and it got to my knuckles and it got painful, I sat down and I shut up. And several hours later, they came to the cell and they called my name and I was being released on an OR. Now, I hadn't been released from jail on an OR in a very long time. And I knew they were making a mistake. But I didn't think I should be the one to tell them about it. They took me to a phone and they told me I could make one phone call. I stood there for 5 minutes. I could not think of one person who I considered a friend that I could come call to come pick me up from Orange County Jail. I certainly couldn't call anyone in my family, and there was nobody that I could call to come pick me up, and I knew isolation and loneliness, and I didn't know that's what I knew. And after about 5 minutes, the name of a woman who had worked for me at one time went through my head, and with that alcoholic arrogance, I called her, and I didn't ask her. I told her to come pick me up in Orange County Jail. And she did. She took me back to my car, and as I was getting out of her car, she looked at me and she said, "Patty, I don't ever want to see you again. I don't want to hear from you. I don't want to hear about you. As far as I'm concerned, you no longer exist." And as she drove off, I gave her one of these, and I thought, then fine, I'll do it myself. See, I'd learned a long time ago that if I needed something done, that I better do it. I couldn't depend on you or they or them. I didn't need her. I didn't need you. I didn't need anyone. If I couldn't do it, it didn't need to get done. And I reconfirmed that commitment that morning. And I got in the car and I did the only thing I knew how to do. I went to the bar and I told the guys how they had done it to me one more time. One more time it was circumstances and conditions. One more time it was you and they and them. One more time it was the cops. One more time it was a lot of things. Never occurred to me it had anything to do with my drinking. I went to court on that drunk driving charge, and I had an 8-month-old son at the time. I never wanted to be a mother. I found out that is not adequate birth control. And I didn't like this kid. He did nothing. He went and he cried. That's all he did. He would not go get a job. He interfered with my life greatly, and I really did not like him. And I'm not proud of that, but that's just how it was. And I was standing in front of the judge that morning, and because of my past record, I was being sentenced to 10 years in prison. I was drunk in court. That's the only way I went to court. It's the only way I went to the work, the grocery store, the laundromat. It's the only way I did anything. And I was standing there drunk that morning. I was being sentenced to 10 years in prison. And I told the judge he couldn't put me in jail because I was a single parent, and I was self-supporting through my own contributions. And I had an 8-month-old child to take care of, and he told me that I was an unfit mother, and that he would put my son in a foster home. And I was being sentenced. In the middle of being sentenced, the expression on his face changed. The tone of his voice got different. And I knew he was as surprised at what he was saying as I was at what I was hearing. Because in the middle of it, he looked at me and he said, "I know this won't work for you, but I'm going to offer you one more chance." And he offered me an alternative. And part of that alternative was meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I wish I could tell you I took the alternative. I came here. I looked at the 12 steps. I knew they were the solution to the problems in my life. I worked them all in the first week and skyrocketed to recovery. But that's not my story. I stood in that courtroom for 5 minutes trying to figure out what I should do. I stood there for 5 minutes trying to figure out if I should take the time or if I should take the alternative. You see, I've been to jail before. But if you've not ever been to jail, the first time you go, it's demoralizing, it's humiliating, it's embarrassing, it's disgusting. Second time you go, it's less demoralizing, it's less humiliating, not nearly as embarrassing. Third time, it's a piece of cake. There's more drugs and alcohol inside the institution than there are some days on the street. If you know what to do, who to do it to, and you're willing to go to any length. And I knew that. And I stood there for 5 minutes, 26 years old, trying to figure out what I wanted to do. And I had what I know today is a moment of clarity. Because as clear as I knew anything, as drunk as I was that morning, I knew that if I went to jail one more time, I would either be institutionalized for life or I would die in the institution. And I didn't know why I knew it that morning, but I knew it as clear as I knew anything. And so I took the alternative, and I drank for 3 more months. In retrospect, I can tell you that I drank with a sense of urgency and a desperation that I had never known. I couldn't have drank a greater quantity. Physically, it would have been impossible to drink a greater quantity of alcohol. But I drank with a sense of urgency and a desperation that I had never known. And on October 4th, 1975, the day before I was to come go back to court to tell the judge what it was I was doing with the alternative he gave me, on that day I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was a Sunday night, and it was a speaker meeting. And I heard 2 things in that meeting. I heard, "We don't drink between meetings." I don't know how that impacted you when you were new, but I quickly looked around and saw nobody was drinking during the meeting. And if you didn't drink between meetings, I couldn't figure out when you did it. And the other thing I heard was that the answers were in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. So after the meeting, I stole the book. I mean, God knows I need to have the answers. I can't tell you how upset I was when I got home. Not only could I not find the answers in that book, I couldn't even find the questions. And I thought, oh, dear God, I've stolen the wrong book, and I'm going to have to go back and get the right one. And I used to, I know about the answer book. I used to teach school, which will let you know that they will give a teaching credential to just about anyone in the state of California. If there's any teachers here, I'd like to make amends. I know you're not nearly as sleazy as I was. I taught second grade. If there's any of you who in your mid-20s who were in San Diego in the second grade and you're illiterate, I'd like to make amends to you. I loved teaching, though. I really did. I love teaching. I'm a compulsive blackboard writer, yet today even I have trouble walking by a blackboard and not writing on it. I love writing on the blackboard, and I love talking. And so I drink in the morning. I mean, I take a bottle to school. I think if you're going to teach second grade, you got to drink all day long. And I'm writing on the board, and I'm teaching, and sometimes what I'm saying goes along with what I'm writing, and I'm having a great day. And then I accidentally turned and looked at the class, and I didn't like to do that much. But I accidentally caught them out of the corner of my eye this one day, and this little boy is jumping up in his seat. And it irritated me because I lost my train of thought. And he's jumping in his chair. I finally said, Johnny, what is it? What do you want? He says, well, Mrs. Ochoa, you spelled mountain wrong. Now, I'm a chronic, hopeless, helpless alcoholic, only I don't know it. One of the manifestations of my disease is justification. I can make anything right that quick without missing a heartbeat. And I said, Johnny, that's very good. Now, I'd like the rest of the class to notice what Johnny's done. Because Johnny was paying attention, he found the word that I spelled incorrectly. Every once in a while, I'm going to spell a word wrong just to see if you're paying attention. And I put Johnny's name on the board. I put a star after it, you know. And I had 30 kids on the edge of their seats from 8:30 in the morning till 3:30 in the afternoon, because we all want stars after our name. We all want stars, and that's a manifestation of my disease. I justify everything. I make everything I do right, no matter what. And I have a reason for it that quick. I don't miss a heartbeat. But because I had taught, I knew about answer books, and I thought, oh, dear Lord, I've taken the wrong book from Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm going to have to go back and get the right one. That's what brought me back to my second meeting. My court program said I had to go to two a week. I thought that was a little obsessive. As a matter of fact, I really couldn't figure out what you had left to tell me. You already told me I couldn't drink between meetings, and you told me where the answers were. What was there possibly left for you to tell me? But I was willing to go to any lengths to stay out of jail. That's the only reason I came to this deal. And so Wednesday, with 4 days of sobriety, I went to my second meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was a small discussion meeting. And in that meeting, I heard, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it. And I looked around the room, and I looked around the room, and I looked around the room, and I could not figure out what it was you had that was so hot that I should be willing to go to any length to get it. Some of you had nice jewelry. If you stood next to me during the Lord's Prayer, if your rings were loose, they were mine. Some of you had nice cars. I have a record for Grand Theft Auto. I know how to get those. Some of you had nice spouses. I knew how to get those. I could not figure out what it was you had that was so hot. And then I saw him. And I truly believe there's a him for each of us. This man was a skinny little fellow. He was bald-headed. He wore baggy pants and a thin belt. He had tennis shoes on with no shoelaces, but the holes were there where they should have been. And he nodded out during the meeting. And I thought, if I have to do this thing and not drink, I'm going to do it his way. So I found out where he worked, and the next day I snuck down to his office. And I went in and I said, Dick, I have to do this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous to stay out of jail, and I don't know how to do it. And he told me if I would go to meetings and read the book and talk to other alcoholics and not drink, he said, I'll guarantee you won't get drunk. And if you don't get drunk, your life will get different. And I'm grateful he told it to me that way. He didn't tell me my life would get better. He didn't tell me my relationships would get better, my family life would get better, my finances would get better, my job situation would get better, my sex life would get better. He didn't tell me any of it would get better, and I'm grateful, because none of it has. I always like to give a little hope to the newcomer. But it's all gotten different. It's all gotten different. As I stand here tonight, I can tell you from the top of my head to the tip of my toes, I have never had it so good. And if I'd have had it my way, I'd have shortchanged myself. You see, when I'm going through something that I think is good for me, it generally turns out to be bad for me. And when I'm going through something I think is bad for me, it generally turns out to be good for me. And I don't know good from bad for me. When I think it's falling apart, if I don't drink and live through it, in retrospect, I have always looked back and saw that what was really happening was it was falling together. And I don't know good better for me, but I know what different is. Every area of my life is different than it was the day I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have never had it so good. And I'm glad that old man told it to me that way, because he didn't lie to me. And I figured, well, all right, I have the book. So every night I'd open it to chapter 3 and I'd read the line that says, most of us are unwilling to admit we are real alcoholics. And I'd say, amen, and close the book. And that was reading the book. As obsessive as I thought it was, I went to the two meetings a week that my court program said I had to go to. I'd go down to the Canyon Club in Laguna Beach where they have AA meetings. I'd have a cup of coffee, and on the way out, I'd say hi, Jim, to the manager, and he'd say hi, Patty, and that was talking to another alcoholic. And the only thing I did right was I didn't drink and I didn't use. And for me, it took 8.5 months of not drinking to get far enough away from my last drink to see the evidence of my alcoholism. It took 8.5 months of not drinking to get far enough away to see what you people saw when I walked through the doors. You knew I belonged here when I walked through the doors, but you gave me the dignity to do what I had to do for as long as I had to do it. Until I could get far enough away from my last drink to see the evidence of my alcoholism. You didn't tell me I had to be an alcoholic. You never told me to go away. All you ever said to me was keep coming back, and I always flip you off. I was not the newcomer that you rushed up to. I hear people say, you know, you loved me until I could love myself. You didn't love me, but you tolerated me, and I'm grateful for that. You didn't love me because I wouldn't let you. You see, I built walls to keep you out. My whole life I built walls to keep you out because I just didn't want to be hurt anymore. It seemed to me my whole life was about being hurt, and I didn't want to be hurt anymore. So I built walls to keep you out, and the walls worked really well. They kept you out. What I never knew about those walls was they made me a prisoner inside. And I knew isolation and loneliness, and I never knew that's what I knew. And when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, the only thing I knew was anger. And I acted it out in a lot of violence in Alcoholics Anonymous. I used to throw chairs across the room, threw one night, broke a plate glass window, cost me about $310 to have it repaired. I was 6 months sober, somebody shared something to me and I didn't like, so I jumped him and was beating his head into the floor. He didn't say it to me, he just shared it. I took it personally. And it took 6 guys to get me off of him, and when they did, I knew they were going to tell me I couldn't come back. And one of those men looked at me and he said, Patty, next time you feel that volcano about to explode, he said, just put your hands in your pockets and don't touch another human being. And I wondered how he knew about the volcano. Nobody had ever talked to me about the volcano before, but I had a volcano inside of me. And when that thing went off, I had to do something. When that thing went off, I wanted to see blood, preferably yours. And Alex told me to put my hands in my pockets and just don't touch another human being. And I had to do that for a long time. Before I was to discover that that anger was a cover for a tremendous amount of fear. I was absolutely scared to death. I was afraid of you. I was afraid of life. I was afraid of me. And I had survived in places where you can't survive if you're afraid. And so I covered that fear with anger. And by the time I got here, I was acting it out in violence. And you gave me the dignity to do that for as long as I had to do it. Until I could get far enough away from my last drink to see the evidence of my alcoholism. I want to talk for a little while on what happened. The what happened for me is the 12 steps of recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. The what happened for me are the steps. There's absolutely no way you can get from where I was to where I am tonight except for the power and the magic of the 12 steps of recovery. When I was 8.5 months sober, I took the first step. I admitted I was powerless over alcohol and that my life had become unmanageable. And what that means for me is whenever I do battle with alcohol, I lose. Whether I'm fighting it because I'm drinking it, or if I'm fighting it because you're drinking it, Whenever I get into the ring with alcohol, I lose. I have a normal friend. I don't understand them. I think they'd have a program for them. Every once in a while, we'll go out to dinner, and we go to the restaurant, and she always seems surprised that they have a bar. I never went anywhere where they didn't have a bar when I went out to dinner, and I rarely ate. And the waitress will come around, and maybe she'll have a glass of wine. Well, then it's a 10-minute decision on what color it's going to be. Who cares about color? And she'll order the glass of wine. They'll bring it. She'll order her meal. They'll bring the food. The glass of wine's still sitting there. She'll start eating her food, and the wine still sits there. And she'll finally reach for it and pick it up and get it right here to her lips. She'll start telling me about her husband, her kids, and her job, and about the dog and the neighbors and quackity, 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 quack, and put the wine down and eat some more and talk some more. And she'll reach for it again and get it right to here. And then she'll start talking to me about her mother-in-law and her job and the lady at work and quack, 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 and it's like, drink this stupid thing. Sometimes she'll finish it, not often. Usually she leaves half of it. Sometimes she'll finish it. The minute it's done, I say, do you want another? She says, well, no, I'm starting to feel it. Well, that's the point. Or she'll say, well, no, I don't like the way it makes me feel. Well, you got to drink through that. You know, and I'm the one who's nuts. It doesn't bother her. Whenever I do battle with alcohol, I lose. And that's the first step for me, whether I'm fighting it because I'm drinking it or if I'm fighting it because you're drinking it. And it's that simple. See, I have been very successful in my life. When I took the first step, I didn't have to discount any of my successes. The things that I had been successful at were truly mine. I didn't have to discount them, and I was grateful for that. Step two says, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. For me, the power greater than myself is not God. For me, if the power greater than myself were God, I could just sit home on my sofa, God would fly by, sprinkle me with sanity, be on his way, and that would be the end of it. I would never have to do another thing. And you see, I've always wanted my life to be that way. I've always wanted you to do it for me. I've always wanted them to take care of it. I would be perfectly content sitting on my sofa letting God sprinkle me with sanity. And I never have to do anything. For me, the power greater than myself is the action of steps 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. For me, taking the action of those steps restored me to sanity. And sanity for me is how I think. We tell new people, I hear us tell new people all the time not to think. I don't know how you do that. I think all the time. I'm talking to you, I'm thinking about something else. And then I start thinking about the fact that I'm thinking. Then I start thinking that I'm thinking what I'm thinking I'm not supposed to be thinking while I'm thinking. And then I start thinking how not to think what I'm thinking while I'm thinking while I'm not supposed to be thinking what I'm thinking. I'm eternally grateful I don't have a loudspeaker on my head. So that everything I think comes barreling out. I mean, that would be truly humiliating. But I think all the time, and the book says God gave us brains to use. I think all the time. What step two did for me was it restored the way that I think. I'm an alcoholic. I'll always be an alcoholic. Every once in a while, I have a thought that a drink would be nice. When I have that thought, I clap. I say, thank you for your participation. I just go about whatever it is that I'm doing. I can have the thought and not take an action. I was raised Catholic. Now I'm still recovering from that, but it's been a painful process. I have stayed sober long enough now to know it wasn't all the Catholic Church. I have a hearing problem. I've always had a hearing problem. A lot of times it's not what you say, it's how I hear it. But what I heard the nuns say was I was going to burn for just as long for thinking it as I was for doing it. Now, I have always been a kind of into action person. And I think if I'm going to burn for thinking it, I'm going to get some enjoyment out of doing it. So everything I thought, I did. I did some things that ahead of time I knew were sleazy and disgusting. But I did have the thoughts, so I did them. What I came to believe in step two was that I could have any thought I wanted to have, but I didn't have to take an action. And I'm happy to tell you that's happened. I've had two major lust attacks while I've been standing up here. so far I haven't had to take an action on either one of them. But the night's still young. I hear people talk about having trouble with step three. You know, I had no trouble with step three. When the pain was so great, my back was against the wall, and it was do it or die, and I had no other choice. Under those circumstances, I looked at step three and saw that it said made a decision. Well, I don't know about you, but I make 1,000 decisions a day. I am really good at making decisions. What I have difficulty with is taking an action to implement the decision. That sometimes gives me some grief, but I have no trouble making a decision. When my back was against the wall and the pain was so great it was do it or die, it was a simple matter to make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood Him. I've turned my will and my life over to the care of alcohol on a daily basis for 13 years. I've turned my will and my life over to the care of people even less qualified than myself a number of times. I've turned my will and my life over to the care of jobs. I've turned my will and my life over to the care of a lot of things. When the pain was great enough, it was a simple matter to make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood Him. I'm happy to tell you, for me, that didn't become a reality until I took the actions of steps 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10. And I'm happy to report that because, for me, my understanding of God changed over and over and over and over through the course of the action of the next 6 steps. Step 4, writing the inventory. My degree, I told you, was in journalism. I, honest to God, I thought writing that inventory was for those of you who didn't have creative writing skills. Those of you who weren't writers probably needed to write this little inventory just to brush up on your writing skills, but I didn't have to do it. And I didn't do it, and I didn't do it, and I didn't do it. And then an interesting thing happened. My sobriety was a gift. You see, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous October 4th, 1975. I had no idea this deal was about not drinking. If I had known that, I wouldn't have come. And yet on that day, for some reason, I didn't drink. And it was not my idea because I never went a day without drinking. I never tried to go a day without drinking. I never even tried to drink less. I'm a good drinker. It was not my idea to not drink that day, and yet that day I didn't drink. And that night I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I was a little over a year sober, I was in the Canyon Club, and a fellow who'd been around for about 20 days had drank that day, and he came into the club that evening pretty drunk. And I talked to him for about 45 minutes, and then I had to go to the bathroom. And when I came back, he was gone, and I asked where he went, and they said he was in his car. So I went out to the parking lot, and he was in his car, and I asked him if he was all right. And he said, yeah, I'm going to go home and sleep it off, but I'll be back tomorrow. And I said, well, I hope so, because I love you. I was 27 years old. I was a little over a year sober, and I had never said the words, I love you, to another human being. My parents told me that I was loved. They told me I was being raised with love any more than their love, and I'd have died. Their love was physically, mentally, and emotionally abusive, and that's what I thought love was. I thought love was this horrible, painful thing, that if I loved you, I was going to hurt you, and if you loved me, you were going to hurt me. And I had made a commitment as a very small child to never love another human being. And I had never said the words, I love you, in my entire life. And yet that night, when I said them to that man, I didn't know what they meant, but I knew what it felt like, and it wasn't that horrible, painful thing I thought love was. And as he drove away, I started to cry, and I hadn't cried since I was 8 years old. And the line in the book that says, those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program, that line went through my head. And that night, I chose to recover in Alcoholics Anonymous. My sobriety was a gift from a very gentle and a very loving God. My recovery has been a choice, and I've continued to make that choice on a daily basis. And when I chose to recover in Alcoholics Anonymous, I started doing what you were doing. I started coming to meetings every night. And then a funny thing happened. I came into a meeting in pain. I sat in the middle of you and felt isolated and alone. I felt different. I felt unique. I knew there was no sense sharing with you because you weren't going to understand anyway. And I left in more pain than I had come in with. And I came in the next night in pain and sat in the middle of you and felt unique, felt different, felt isolated, felt alone, knew there was no sense sharing because you weren't going to understand anyway, and I left in more pain than I had come in with. And I did that night after night after night after night until the pain of being with you was so great that I knew I had to leave Alcoholics Anonymous. I could not stay here in the kind of pain I was in. And that night on my way out the meeting, I had a thought. And the thought was, before you leave Alcoholics Anonymous, why don't you try writing this inventory? And so I went home and I got the book down and I did my four step exactly the way the book says to do it. I made the little columns. I wrote who I was resentful at. Well, pretty much everybody who breathed air that I thought should have been mine ended up on that list. Second column, what they did to me. Well, I wanted to tell you all my life what they did to me. I mean, I was starting to have a lot of fun with this, what they did to me, how it affected me. It affected my self-esteem, my self-worth, my pride, my integrity. Well, no wonder I drank. If all these people did all these things to you that affected you this way, you'd have drank too. And I was having a great time doing this fourth step till I accidentally turned the page. Two pages later, hidden in the body of the text, it says, referring to our list again, putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done, we looked for our part. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking? The inventory was ours, not the other man's. Well, now it wasn't any fun anymore. Now I had to write my part, and that was my inventory. And I did it with resentments, fears, and relationships exactly the way the book says to do. And I knew I belonged in Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew I could share with you. You may not have exactly the same experience, but I somehow knew that we all have exactly the same story. We just acted it out a little bit differently. And I knew I belonged. Then I looked at step five, and I, honest to God, I thought step five was for those of you who weren't raised Catholic. Those of us who are Catholic, we know about confession, and we know it doesn't work. And I thought sharing this thing was to give the rest of you the experience that we had, and I didn't have to do it, and I wasn't going to do it. So I put my fourth step in the trunk of my car, and then I drove around with a sense of impending doom. And the fear was I was going to get rear-ended on the freeway, my trunk would fly open, and my fourth step would be everywhere. Rather than do a fifth step, I chose to drive around that way for a very long time. And then one night I was in Los Angeles visiting a friend of mine, and we were talking. And as we were talking, it occurred to me I was doing my fifth step. Now, I would not have picked this woman to do a fifth step with. She had 2 weeks less sobriety than I did. My program, as you can tell, was not red hot, but hers was worse than mine. And I would not have picked her to do it with. But because this was my experience, I know that God will put the person in front of you with whom you're supposed to share. And I figured if I'm doing it, I'm going to do it right. And I went to the car and I got my fourth step and I went back and I finished my fifth step with her. And when I got through, she looked at me and she said, Patty, one day the things you have listed as your greatest assets will become your greatest liabilities. And the things that you have listed as your greatest liabilities will become your greatest assets. And I thought, oh, wonderful, I have just done a fifth step with a woman who has lost her last swing nut. I need to tell you the things that I have always thought were my greatest assets in Alcoholics Anonymous become my greatest liabilities. And the things I thought were my greatest liabilities here become my greatest assets. And I don't know how that happened. An example, I've always been a very strong woman. I don't know if this is true for strong men because I've never met one to confirm this with, but... You know, I was on my knees in the ladies' room. I pray before I do this. This is God's business. It's coming from somewhere else. It's not coming from me. If you're a strong person, it's very difficult to ask for help. If you're a strong person, it's very difficult to ask for help. And that strength has always been an asset. Here it becomes a liability because whenever I try to do anything by myself, I shortchange myself. These cars are being towed for illegal parking. Okay, this one here I might want. There's an 80... an 83 Chevy that belongs to Michael Dickerson. Michael's probably at the hotel with his girlfriend, right? An 88 Ford that belongs to Judy Vallejo, and an 87 Ford Motor Corp, David something, Mikla. It's a lease car, you can let him have that one. Okay, an 87 Ford, an 88 Ford, and an 83 Chevy. In the fire lane. Ooh. Okay, so... Are you guys going to get your cars? You don't want anybody to know who you are?
Okay.
the good stuff till you get back. So whenever I try to do anything by myself, I shortchange myself. Whenever I ask one of you to walk with me, you open new doors and you add to my life. So that strength becomes a liability in Alcoholics Anonymous. I went home from doing my fifth step, and I accidentally did steps 6 and 7. I, honest to God, I did not mean to recover this quickly. I accidentally took the book down and opened it to the part about steps 6 and 7. Now, every newcomer will tell you how poorly the book is written. I mean, you don't have to be a journalism major to know that. Every newcomer will tell you how poorly the book Alcoholics Anonymous is written. And it is, but that part around steps 6 or 7 gets real poetic. And it's real short. It's just a paragraph here and two paragraphs there, and it kind of lulled me into it. And before I was aware of what I was reading, I was in the middle of the seven-step prayer. And when I became aware of what I was reading, I knew that I believed it. And the thing that it says in the book happened to me. I walked through the archway to freedom. I walked away from the person I had been all of my life to start to become the person God intended for me to be. For me, that's the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous. We have an opportunity here to walk away from the person we've been all of our life to start to become the person God intended for us to be. And if that hasn't happened to you yet, please stay with us until it does. Please stay here long enough to give yourself a chance to start to become the person God intended for you to be. The best I have ever described myself. When I came here, I was an animal with latent human tendencies. That's what walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. As a result of these steps, as a result of you sharing with me how to live life, as a result of you showing up on a daily basis and allowing me to sit with you and watch you and listen to you, I have become very kind, very loving, very nurturing, very caring. Of course, now they're telling me it's codependency and I have to recover from it, but... But I really like the person who I am today. I love the person who I've become as a result of these steps. I'm tempted to write a book, Women Who Love Themselves Too Much. I love the person who I am, and I know beyond a shadow of a doubt there's no way to get here from where I was. There's absolutely no way to get here from where I was except for the power and the magic of these steps. Steps 8 and 9 for me are simply conventional ways of getting rid of conventional guilt. I was in a meeting one day and a woman was saying, I feel so guilty, I feel so guilty. And I very lovingly said, you feel guilty because you are guilty. I did a lot of things out there to get what I needed. I did a lot of things to you. I did a lot of things to other people. I did a lot of things to get what I needed for me. And I didn't care about you, and I didn't care about them, and I didn't care how it hurt you. All I cared about was me and getting what I needed for me. And I had a lot of wreckage to clean up as a result of that. I had my list for step 8 from my fourth step, and I very arrogantly said to God, all right, God, if you want me to make amends to these fools, you put them in my face because I'm not going looking for them. People started showing up this quick. I had people in my face I'd forgotten to put on the list. You know, I had to quick get them down there to make amends, and I began to clean up my side of the street. I have a sponsor who's a real nag. I mean, this woman is a true pain in the neck nag. Now, I know none of you have sponsors like this. Certainly the women I sponsor don't have this complaint, but my sponsor would just get off on these tangents that had absolutely nothing to do with her. And one of her tangents was my unfinished business. I was a big starter. I started a lot. And then I'd kind of poop out or lose interest or go on a different... I didn't finish a lot of stuff. And she got on this tangent about my unfinished business, and she wanted me to finish up some of this stuff. Now, what does this have to do with my sobriety? And she's in my ear, so to shut her up, which is the only reason I do anything, I said, all right, and I started cleaning it up. And one of my unfinished businesses was this master's degree. Now, I had taken the classes, but in my field, I had to take 2-day oral exams, and I just hadn't done that. And so she was big on this one. This was a big one for her. And so I called San Diego State, and I told the woman, I wanted to tell her about my sponsor who was nagging at me, but I didn't. I said, I know I'm going to have to take some classes, and what do I need to do to finish up this degree? She put me on hold. She came back, and she said, well, our records indicate that you have a master's degree. I said, no, you don't understand. I had to take 2-day oral exams. I never did that. And she said, well, our records indicate. I said, oh, well, what do you know? And I hung up. Now, I don't even want this degree, but now I'm obsessed with it because I've gotten a hold of a dummy on the phone. So I started calling all over town trying to find the guy that was the head of my master committee. I finally find him, and I explain my dilemma to him, and he says, Patty, you have a master's degree. I said, Jack, I had to take 2-day oral exams. He said, you did. I said, well, how did I do? He said, you were brilliant. I said, well, of course, and hung up the phone. Called my sponsor, told her she had humiliated me one more time, but I did that kind of stuff. I did that stuff. I was $40,000 in debt. I wanted to wait till I had $40,000, and I'll send it off. My kind, loving sponsor said, you will never have $40,000. You will start sending $5 to them, $6 to them, $10 to them. When I was a little over 10 years sober, I was out of debt. Of course, I've created new debt, but I think you have to do that in order to keep having the willingness to recover in Alcoholics Anonymous. Steps 10, 11, and 12, for me, I hear people talk about them as maintenance steps. Now, I don't know what you're maintaining, but I had very little to maintain when I got to 10, 11, and 12. I had finally broken even. Step 9, for me, I had gotten even. I'd gotten right with you, and because I was right with you, I was right with me. And because I was right with me, for the first time in my life, I was right with God. And I could look eyeball to eyeball with every other human being, and I was even. Steps 10, 11, and 12 for me are the growth steps. They're the steps that keep me moving up the spiral of recovery. Our recovery for me is a spiral. It's not a straight line. It's a little spiral upward. Step 10, when I'm wrong, I can promptly admit it. Prompt has gotten down to about 8 or 9 minutes where it used to be about 8 or 9 weeks. I don't like the way I feel when I do something to harm one of you or to harm someone else. I don't like the way I've sent out a virtue. It's because I don't like the way it feels. And so I make amends promptly. I'm a very simple person. I've always been very simple. For me, my prayer in the morning is very simply, thy will be done. And I am so naive that I believe the rest of the day is God's business. My job is to get up and not drink, show up and live life, and the rest of it is God's business. I know beyond a shadow of a doubt that I'm supposed to be here tonight, because if I weren't, I would be somewhere else. I know beyond a shadow of a doubt that this is exactly where I'm supposed to be. My life is God's business. My job is to not drink and to show up and live life to the fullest. Step 12, I was really excited about when I was new. I liked the part about practice these principles in all our affairs. I thought it meant I was going to get to have a lot. Unhappy to report, that isn't exactly what it means. I hate 12-step calls. I hate 12-step calls. I don't know why. No, why doesn't anyone want to get sober at noon? They want to get sober about 2:15 in the morning. Now, Orange County Central Office, how they know this, I don't know. 99% of the time, I sleep alone. That's a tough crowd. No sympathy here, is there? Somehow, Central Office knows the 1% of the time that I have somebody spending the night. And I don't know, it must be my sponsor. I don't know who tells them. That's the night the phone rings at 2:15. And I have to get out of my warm, very active bed. And I moan and I groan and I complain. I know she doesn't want to get sober. She just wants somebody to come babysit her. And so I call somebody I sponsor, usually somebody who's just gotten into a relationship, because I figure if I'm going to suffer, she's going to suffer too. And I go pick her up, and I bitch and moan and grumble all the way to the house. And I get there, and I always knock on the door way too hard, and I hate every single minute of it until the door opens, and I look in the eyes, and I see the pain, and I see the hurt, and I see the fear, and I see the incomprehensible demoralization, and I see the degradation, and I see the stuff in the eyes that were in my eyes when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And then it becomes the greatest gift you have ever given me, is the ability to share my dark, sleazy, nasty past with another human being, and to let her know that she doesn't have to live that way anymore, that there's a way out, that if you don't drink, you don't get drunk, and if you don't get drunk, your life will get different. And it's the greatest gift you have ever given me. I have done everything wrong in Alcoholics Anonymous. I need to let you know that. I've sat in meetings and taken your inventory and then rushed quickly to another meeting and shared it. I'm judgmental. I'm rigid as the day is long. I've slept with newcomers, and I'd do it again in a hot minute if I had a chance. Old-timers, as long as they don't talk about God, you know. I've charged for 12-step calls. I went on a 12. I was in visiting my mother one day, and I go to meetings when I visit my mother. She lives in a different town, and if you visited my mother, you'd go to a meeting too. And so I know some of the people in the area where she lives, and I was there visiting one day, and one of the women called and asked me if I'd go on a 12-step call. And this woman had been in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know we say, you know, that you're always welcome, but there comes a time when people get burned out, when you keep coming back and going out and coming back and going out. I do. I get burned out because I get scared to death that you're going to die. And these folks had gotten pretty burned out, and they couldn't get anybody to go, and she just happened to call my mother's, and I was there, so I went. And we got to the house. If money could keep you sober, this woman would have never had a problem. She had the biggest house I had ever seen. It took a quarter tank of gas to get from the street up her driveway to the house. She had a big oak door, which was cracked open. We walked in, and she had one of those spiral staircases, and there are some of you old enough to remember. I think it was Gail Garnett, the old Schick commercial, where she came down that spiral staircase with wine and vomit all over. This woman came down a staircase exactly like that. And she got down to where we were, and I sent the other woman into the kitchen to make coffee, and I looked in this woman's eye, and I said, you know, I know that you can't stay sober, but it's not your fault. The problem is the people in this town won't give you the secret of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I can't just give you the secret, but for $100, So she pulled $100 out of her. I should have asked for more. I mean, she just pulled it right out and gave me the money and put it in my pocket, and I looked her in the eye, and I said, if you don't drink, you won't get drunk. And if you don't get drunk, your life will get different. And about then, the woman who had taken me on the call came out, and I said, well, we don't have to be here anymore, and we left. When that woman took a cake for 1 year of sobriety, I gave her back her $100. And never once during that time did she ever tell anybody I charged her for that 12-step call. And I just saw her over the Christmas holidays, and she's a very active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, a lot of 12-step calls, and she's just a delight, as so many of us are when we finally come here and stay. We're going to end on time because of the raffles coming up next, and that's probably next to the dance, the most important part, and the 3-hour dinner. The dinner was wonderful. Made me feel like I was in one of those French restaurants where they serve 17 courses over a 3-hour period of time. Well, it was wonderful, just kind of lounging around. How many of us ever take that much time to eat a meal? I just think it's a luxury to take that much time to eat a meal. Me, I usually inhale it, and I'm like, you know, on the way to the door out of my house for somewhere else. And it was just a pleasure. It was just a very nice experience. But we are going to finish on time. I want to tell you a little bit of what it's like today. My son, who was 11 months old when I got sober, who was going to a foster home, didn't. Some days that's good, and some days that's not so good. He's 16. Those of you who are parents of adolescents will understand what that means. He nods, shrugs, and grunts. You know, that's his. And he's a wonderful, wonderful human being. I brought him with me to Alcoholics Anonymous. He was 11 months old. I would bring him, and you would take him and hold him and bounce him on your lap and do whatever you did and give him back to me, and I'd bring him to the next meeting, and you would love him. And you taught my son how to love. I couldn't teach him. I didn't know. You taught him how to love. You taught him how to be gentle. He watched men in Alcoholics Anonymous cry, and he knew that was okay. You taught us how to be friends, and when you could, you taught us how to love one another. And he just has grown up to be one of the most wonderful human beings, absolutely my best friend. You taught him everything he knows about compassion, understanding. You also taught him how to con and manipulate, and I guess I have to take the good with the bad, but I took him with me to a meeting. He's probably been to more meetings than most of the women I sponsor. And he was going with me one night to a meeting, and he just looked at me and he said, "Mom, I'm glad you don't drink anymore. So I don't think I would have liked you when you drank." And I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous for that. I just came here to stay out of jail. That's all I wanted out of this deal. And I have gotten so much more. I have people in my life today who I love, and I can let them love me. And I don't have to be afraid that I'm going to get hurt anymore. And sure, we do once in a while. Somebody steps on our toes. Somebody says something that hurts our feelings. But you've given me tools to deal with that. I don't have to jump into a bottle of Jack Daniels in order to medicate that pain. You've given me the tools to deal with it. Life happens. I went to the mall over Christmas and did not get a parking space in front of May Company. Life happens. I've had flat tires. Last month I was laid off from a job that I loved, that I'm really, really good at. It was just a wonderful opportunity for me, and out of the blue I got laid off. And that was not a pleasant experience, but I know that God never closes one door without opening another. Of course, right now I'm hoping it's going to be a trap door under the fellow who laid me off, but but I know that that'll pass too, and I know that this is an opportunity and a learning experience for me. I keep trying to trick God and tell him I've learned the lesson. but I guess in time, when the time's right, whatever the next opportunity is, will present itself. And I found out a lot of things about some of my old ideas. I have real old ideas about people who don't work. I have worked all my life. I had some real negative ideas about people who don't work. When you're unemployed, those ideas change quickly. I started letting those puppies go real fast. And life happens. What I know from my experiences is you have given me a kit of tools. And you didn't just hand it to me and say, "Here's your tools." You have showed me day after day after day after day how to use the tools. When I get into the toolbox and get a sledgehammer, you say, "No, Patty, try a Phillips screwdriver. It may work better. Here, let me show you how to use it." You have been examples for me. You have taught me how to live life on a daily basis. I come here for an hour and a half, and I listen to you, and I have 22 and a half hours to live life to the fullest. I don't have to drink and use to medicate my pain. I don't have to run from life in a bottle of Jack Daniels. I don't have to look out there for anything. Everything I need is right here and in the 12 steps of recovery. I have never had it so good. And you see, all I came here for was to stay out of jail. That's all I wanted. And I have gotten so much more. If you're new or relatively new when you go home tonight, write down what it is you expect to have happen to you in Alcoholics Anonymous. Then put that paper away somewhere. Next year, when you have 1 year of sobriety, take the paper out and read it and find out if you'd had it your way, you'd have shortchanged yourself. If ever I would have it my way, I would shortchange myself. I hear people say, you know, "I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and it hasn't been necessary for me to drink or use since the day I walked through the doors." I want you to know it's been necessary for me to drink and use. It's been critically necessary for me to drink. It's been urgently necessary. It's been desperately necessary. It's been overwhelmingly necessary for me to drink. But because the steps work, as necessary as it's been, I haven't had a drink and I hadn't used a drug since the day I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I never planned to stay this long. It takes a lot of courage to stay sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't have the courage that it takes. And I come here and I sit with one of you, and the person next to me has just a little bit extra courage, and they give it to me so that I can stay for one more day. This job that I just recently lost, I was recruited to it, and I went through all kinds of changes when I was being recruited, and I kept telling them I didn't want it, and I didn't like it, and I didn't want to do that. And a little blue-haired lady, you know, and it's always the blue-haired ladies. I was in my home meeting talking about this thing, and she looked at me and she said, "Patty," she said, "I know the problem is you're just afraid. So you don't have the courage to take that job. You don't have the strength But I have just a little extra courage and strength, so here, you take some of mine, and you tell them you'll take that job, and you show up there. And I went to that job with that lady's courage and that lady's strength. Everything I do, I take a little of your courage and a little of your strength, because I don't have it. I can't do this by myself. I need you more today than I have ever needed you. At the end of the Lord's Prayer, we always say, keep coming back. And what I'd rather say instead is, don't go away. Now that you're here, don't go away. You never have to drink again if you don't want to, one day at a time, as long as you continue to choose to recover. Recovery is an escalator up, walking up a down escalator. I go to the mall and I walk in on the first floor and I want to go to the second floor, so I scoot over to the escalator. But I always come to the escalator going down. You can get from the first floor to the second floor on the down escalator, but you got to keep moving. If I stop moving, I start going down. I don't hit ground right away, but I start going down. And I got to start moving again real quick before I hit ground. And that's what recovery is for me. It's about walking up the down escalator. It's a program of action. I got to take the action. It's not a program of analyzing or thinking or it's a program of action. I got to take the action of walking up the down escalator. And I have to do it on a daily basis. I always end with what Dick told me when I was 4 days sober. If you don't drink, you won't get drunk. If you don't get drunk, your life will get different. And the other thing I know beyond a shadow of a doubt, we already heard when Jackie read a portion of chapter 5. And it too has been my experience. And it's a line in chapter 5 that says, there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Thank you.